to keep on fighting.
We're going to leave it right there. That's Martina Spada, Camille Perez Bustillo. I'm Dennis Bernstein, and we're done.
Welcome to Book Waves. I'm Richard Walensky.
In honor of Pride, Mart Crowley's play, The Boys in the Band, which deals with the lives of gay men in the 1960s, burst upon the off-Broadway scene in 1968 and ran for 1,000 performances. It became a film directed by William Friedkin 2 years later. In 2002, Mart Crowley wrote a sequel titled The Men from the Boys, which took place 35 years later, after Stonewall and after the AIDS epidemic. It premiered at San Francisco's New Conservatory Theater on November 9, 2002, and I had a chance to speak with Mart Crowley shortly before the official opening as he worked with director Ed Decker on the project. Sadly, Mart Crowley died of a heart attack on March 7, 2020, at the age of 84.
Mart Crowley, for many people, of course, they remember The Boys in the Band, and here we are some 35 years later.
34.
You haven't disappeared. You've kept working. You have several plays. Is that correct?
That is correct, and there are some weird credits, too, in television that kept me going through the years.
What are the weird credits?
It's weird from the beginning, because the way I got my first job before The Boys in the Band was I went home for Christmas from college in 1956, and Ilya Kazan was shooting Baby Doll with Carl Malden and Carol Baker, and Tennessee Williams was sitting practically next to my house. I just ingratiated myself, shall I say. Later, Kazan told me that I was the most unrelenting pest he'd ever met. But he did write out a pass for me to get on the set on a napkin in Doe's Eat Place, and where they all congregated every night and had a few drinks and unwound. I said, oh God, I've got to come work for you. I've got to be involved in this business. He said, no, go back to college, get your education. When you're finished, come to New York and look me up. So that's just what I did. When I hit New York, I didn't even have to look him up. I got a job on a Mickey Rooney quickie 3-week shoot on a remake of The Last Mile as a production assistant. So I had some experience when I met him. And I was walking home from work one night on 57th Street when all the art galleries there, and I saw this man looking in the window at a painting. And I thought, that sort of hunched back man looks like Ilya Kazan. I walked over to the back of him and said, Mr. Kazan. He turned around. And I said, I'm that boy from Mississippi. He said, I know exactly who you are. And he said, what are you doing? I said, I'm working on The Last Mile with Mickey Rooney. And he said, well, I thought you wanted to come work for me. And I said, oh, I do. This will be over in another week. And so he said, come over to the office. We'll see what we can get you to do. Well, we started preparing the next picture, which happened to be Splendor in the Grass.
What did you do for Kazan at that point?
Well, I did everything at that point from, you know, what we call bicycle. In New York, it's a little different than on a lot in Hollywood, but I did everything from bicycle, the script and revision changes from William Inge's apartment in Sutton Place to 125th Street. Bicycling meaning I took the subway. And I made Greek salads. Kazan taught me how to make a Greek salad that he liked, so I made his lunch every day.
Well, Mark Crowley, what brought you to write a play like Boys in the Band? It was an extraordinary breakthrough play, though obviously when you were writing it, you didn't think breakthrough at all.
No. Well, one thing that contributed to it was on Splendor in the Grass, I became friendly with, I transferred my affections from Kazan to Natalie Wood, and she knew I wanted to be a writer, and she got West Side Story during that, before Splendor was completed. In fact, West Side had started shooting in New York already, and they were waiting for a Maria to be cast. So she said, I can't possibly get out of here. I got to go fly back to L.A., start dance rehearsal on Monday. Who's going to pack up the apartment? Who's going to get everything? You don't have a job. Kazan has already told you that he's going to Greece for 3 years to prepare America, America. So I'll tell you what. If you will pack up the apartment, see that everything is shipped back, I'll go to William Morris, and we'll get you an agent on the West Coast. I said, deal. So I did, and she did. And I got a job, and I wrote an original script for her, and it was bought by Fox, and we got it set up into production, and 2 weeks before production, Zanuck canceled the picture. That was the first blow in Hollywood. And then the second blow was I did indeed write a pilot for Bette Davis for Quaker Oats, of all things. But she was a diva, you know, and she could never have adjusted to the pace of a television series. So Quaker Oats canceled that before they even showed it. It was a dead pilot on arrival. However, I did become friendly with her, which was something. And the third time, I got hired by Paramount to do an original. And I got put in one of those cubbyholes like in Sunset Boulevard. In fact, I was in the same one that Betty Schaefer and Joe Gillis try to write Tonight's the Night or whatever the hell they're working on. And then I got fired. So I was broke, depressed, angry, very angry. So there was a European actor coming in to shoot a film. I knew him. And a very wealthy woman whose husband owned the New York Post and had 4 children, a Swedish nanny, a Chinese couple who made and served dinner, all these kind of Hispanic gardeners, and blah, blah, blah. It was international house, you know. So it was Diana Lynn, the actress, if you remember her from the 40s in Preston Sturges movies. And she called me up and she said, Mart, would you house sit? Well, we're going to take our yacht and go through the Panama Canal to Nassau and then fly the children there. We're not going to put them through all this. And she said, if anybody falls down the stairs and breaks their neck, nobody can call the doctor in English around here. So I said, okay. And I moved into this glorious mansion that Bill Cosby later bought from after she died, on Tower Road in Beverly Hills, right around the corner from the Selznick's. In fact, I used to give people directions to the house by saying, well, you go up the Tower Road and turn left at the Selznick's. I thought turn left at the Selznick's would be a good title for a book, you know, how to get to me.
Right.
So there I was, sitting in the laps of luxury, but earning no money except the income from the European actor who was staying in my sublet apartment. And I thought, I've got to do something. I'll be here 7 weeks. So I started scribbling on bed as the Chinese servant brought me my breakfast on a tray into my bed. I just picked up a yellow legal pad and started scribbling, you know.
And that was Boys in the Band.
Yeah. And about a week later, the pages were all piling up, so I decided to unzip the Olivetti, and go down to the library and start typing out the notes first, and then just going from there. The kids would come home from school in the afternoon. They were fine. They had a Swedish nanny looking after them. And I remember Matthew Hall was about 10 years old, and he'd say, Uncle Mark, what are you writing today? I said, I'm writing a play.
Well, the characters in the play are apparently based on people you knew, or at least so you later said.
Mm-hmm. They were. And me, you know, I mean, there's a dash of me in all of them.
But there's also your character who pops up in several of your plays, in obviously three plays at least, The Boys in the Band, Breeze from the Gulf, and now The Men from the Boys, is Michael.
You know, his initials are MC. He's Michael Connelly. I'm Mark Crowley. So, I mean, not too hard to figure out.
The other characters, Emery, the very effeminate man, or Harold, the quote ugly pockmarked Jew, or Donald, the I guess the more suave guy, who are the main other characters beside Michael.
Mm-hmm.
Are they specifically based on people, or are they composites?
Both. Harold was specifically based on a fellow called Howard Jeffrey, who was my best friend and Jerome Robbins' personal assistant. He taught Natalie all the dances on West Side Story, and that's how I met him. And Emery is a composite of three guys that I knew.
And Donald?
Oh, Donald was a real close friend of mine. In fact, the plays are dedicated. That play, The Boys in the Band, is dedicated, if you notice in the dedication page, to Howard Jeffrey, who was Harold, and to Douglas Murray, who was Donald. And they were quite a different part, and they were very proprietary about me. They despised each other. And I could never see them, you know, like the three of us. That was impossible. But it was either me with Harold or me with Donald.
But you got them all in the same room.
Well, whenever
in your
they
play.
Came across each other, you know, they would just sneer. And actually, Howard was the more acerbic and faster one on the draw, if you will. But Donald was a real intellectual.
The Boys in the Band. Did you expect, after its emergence, did you expect the reaction that you received? And did you, were you astonished at the fact that they actually did want to make a movie out of it?
Well, no, I didn't expect it, but I can't claim complete, you know, like I was in a cocoon not knowing what I was doing, because I was warned by too many people that I had worked for. Dominic Dunn had me under contract at a place called Four Star Television. When I was writing this play, I told Dominic Dunn about it, what I was doing. And he really seriously thought maybe I was having a nervous breakdown. He said, you know, I think it's wonderful. My contract there had run out. I remember I went to a party at a Malibu beach house, and he looked at me looking like a sad sack in the corner and said, come on, Mark, let's go for a walk on the beach. We took two glasses of white wine in those days and started walking down the sands barefoot. What are you doing? I told him about The Boys in the Band. He listened, and he saw how passionate I was about it, and he heard what the content was. And he turned to me and he said, I think it's really very therapeutic of you to keep working. But listen, Mark, if nobody wants to do this play, don't let it throw you, please.
Was there any other play, any other film, anything that was about gay men in the way that Boys in the Band was?
No, not the way it was, but I mean, you know, there were other plays. There's a compendium of plays of the 20th century that's coming out from Applause Books, in which The Boys in the Band is included, that go back to the early roots. I should think that the most famous ones, well, famous to me, I mean, because I knew the history quite well, The Green Bay Tree, in which Laurence Olivier was in, and The Well of Loneliness for Lesbians, which was first a novel by Radcliffe Hall and then was translated for the stage. The Captive, which got closed on Broadway the same week that Mae West's Sex was closed.
So there is some history there.
Yeah, Sex wasn't about gays.
Right.
But she did write one after that called The Drag, which was closed in Jersey, let alone New York.
Boys in the Band seemed, when I saw the film at least, a few years later, it seemed to me that you took a little bit, or at least the sense, maybe I'm wrong, of Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf, because there is that kind of party atmosphere. Throw these people together and watch the sparks fly.
Yeah, a lot of people have asked me about that, and I can't deny it. I was in the thrall of Albee, and he actually was one of the people that helped get this produced, because he, with two partners, Richard Barr, who had been an actor in Orson Welles' Mercury Theater and become a producer, had produced Virginia Woolf. And they had a third partner. And when I took this play to an agent in New York, she got so mad that she couldn't look me in the eye. She started straightening the pencils and all the objects on her desk at right angles to each other and being OCD-ish. And she said, "I don't know who I could send this out." She's smoking like a house on fire too. "I don't know who I could send this out. I wouldn't send it out under my... It's like some weekend at Fire Island." And I said, "Well, exactly." And she said, no, not this agency. We couldn't possibly do it." And then I was almost in tears because she was about to throw me out. So I said, "Do you know Richard Barr?" And she said, "Of course I know Richard Barr. Why do you ask that?" And I said, "Well, anybody who produced Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf wouldn't blink twice at this play. Would you send it to him?" She said, "Not under my letterhead, but I'll send it to him." Well, did she eat crow? I mean, the next day, people hardly ever read plays. You know, months goes by before you get something back from a dramaturg these days, whatever the hell that word means. And Barr called back the next day and said, "I got to meet this kid." She was more stunned than anybody. She called me up and she said, "Are you sitting down? You're not going to believe this." I said, "What?" She said, "Richard Barr and Edward Albee want to have a drink with you at 5 o'clock in Mr. Barr's apartment. Can you make it?" I said, are you kidding me? Jesus. So I went at the Village, and that was the beginning of that. They ran an experimental, they were very good about promoting young playwrights, theater space on 25 Van Damme Street. I'll never forget it as long as I live. And they put on plays, and the people they put on plays by, there was John Guare and Lanford Wilson and Terrence McNally and me and Sam Shepard. And I mean, it just went on and on and on. It was incredible.
And the play eventually did get produced.
Well, it did. It was to be 5 nights, kind of a word of mouth thing. I asked a few friends. The first night it poured with rain, just poured with rain. Everything bad could happen. I looked out in the front of the theater, and there was a line down the block with people with umbrellas. And I said to Bob Moore, the director, I said, "My God, it looks like the third act of Our Town." And all under those umbrellas were Leonard Bernstein and Betty Comden and, Toot New York. The theater world. Jerry Robbins came, and I had met him on West Side Story, and so we embraced again. He was so happy for me, and I said, "Happy for me? Well, nothing's happened yet." He said, it will.
So it played those 5 nights. Did it get reviewed?
No, but it was. They were turning people away. It stopped raining, but they were turning people away so much that they extended it for 4 more performances. That's all they could get away with. Equity said, "You have to start to pay these actors after this." They were doing it for free. But by that time, Barr had already told me that he was going to transfer it off-Broadway. This was in January of 68, and it transferred in April of 68.
And it ran off-Broadway for how long?
Well, it was to run 1,000 performances. Richard wanted to close it on 1,000 performance night, and I said, "Oh no, let's make it 1,001 nights." So it ran 1,001 performances. It was still running when the movie came out, and that was 2 years later.
And
more people went to see the play than they did the movie.
Though, of course, over the years, the movie has gained a following too.
Yeah.
And it's pretty much the original cast.
Yes, and of course, at that time, it was a studio system and you had to have known people. Paramount tried to buy the play. Bob Evans, the famous Bob Evans of Chinatown and Godfather, he flew to New York and tried to pry it out of me by a breakfast at the Regency Hotel. But, you know, I said, well, who are you going to put in it? And he said, oh, George Siegel. And I started naming these names, you know. And I said, no, I don't think so. I'd rather get less money for it and have some control over it. He said, well, you'll never get that from anybody.
But you did.
Yes, because CBS was starting up a cinema wing just at that time, and they wanted to buy hot, explosive properties, and they bought this.
You're listening to a 2002 interview with Mart Crowley about his play The Men from the Boys, which is a sequel to the smash hit The Boys in the Band. Mart Crowley died of a heart attack on March 7th, 2020. I'm Richard Walensky on Bookwaves.
Mart Crowley, next 30 years after Boys in the Band, you wrote several plays.
Mm-hmm.
Some of them got produced, some of them didn't get produced.
Mm-hmm.
What brought you back to the characters?
Well, you know, people don't believe me when I say that people have always been asking me to write a sequel. Richard Barr, the producer of The Boys in the Band, was one of the ones who badgered me over the years. Naturally, he wanted to produce one. He thought, you know, if one worked and I made a lot of money off of it, well, two will. But I just didn't have anything to say. AIDS hadn't happened, you know, yet. It was a long way between 68 and 81. The other plays that I was writing about, I wrote about my childhood and went back in time, not further.
And that was Breeze from the Gulf.
Yeah, that was Breeze from the Gulf. And there was a play called Remote Asylum, too, which was the most gigantic flop of them all, starring Mr. William Shatner.
As Michael? The Michael character?
No, there was a Michael character, but he was played by an actor called Ralph Williams. And boy, do I know I'm getting old. When I last saw Ralph, he was playing Cap Mandy in the revival of Showboat.
Now, by 81, I mean, when you could have written the sequel, of course, the gay liberation movement had already begun. San Francisco seemed gay. You'd already had, by that point, Harvey Milk had come into power and died.
Uh-huh.
So conceivably, and Fire Island was going full tilt, conceivably you could have done something then, but you chose not to.
Oh, no, I didn't really choose not to. I was up to my armpits in other things. Very, very lightweight stuff, but nevertheless, I was producing a TV series called Heart to Heart, which I did for 5 years.
And then AIDS happened, and I guess at that point you didn't want to write it.
I don't know. AIDS began immediately to take its toll on me. I mean, I, like everybody, I was suspicious that I wasn't HIV positive and then going into full AIDS myself. But my friends did, well, particularly one that is written about in this latest play, found out that he was HIV and came and told me and eventually succumbed.
Now we come up to the millennium. AIDS, while certainly still a problem, terrible problem, people are surviving with AIDS longer and longer.
Mm-hmm.
What brought you back to these characters and also the decision to have all of them survive AIDS?
But who knows what secretly is Michael's status in the play? He never reveals that. They do say about some of the other people that existed in the first play, what do you suppose ever became of them?
And it's assumed they've died, yeah.
Well, the answer is, he's probably dead, or if not, just lost in the night somewhere.
How hard was it for you to get back into the state of mind of the 30-year-old Los Angeles up-and-comer who actually wrote The Boys in the Band, to be able to go back and remold those characters?
Well, you know, every play that I've ever written that have been successful or not successful, I've just started the first page one, page two, page three, page four, and then type the end. I just wrote it from beginning to end. I never wrote the structure down on a pad or anything. It just came in my head automatically. This play was generated by the fact that the character who is HIV, who does it, obviously is going to die of AIDS. Well, I don't know how obvious it is in the play, but that's what happened in life. He came to me. He was my best friend. He came to me and told me he was sick And he'd been sick for months without telling me. Well, we had this really surreal scene. He came over to unburden himself, to tell me something very serious. And what happened? We got into a fierce argument with each other as to why he hadn't told me sooner. It made him more furious, made me more furious. It did resolve with, "I'll be there for you, you know that." But nevertheless, he slammed out of the apartment, angrier than he was when he came in. And I was furious, and then I calmed down. I didn't close the door and go to type out the scene, but a day or two later, it occurred to me that what was said between us, or the essence of what was said, was a scene. Maybe it's the one I play, I don't know, I didn't know what it was. So I wrote it all down, and it was very long, much longer than it turned out to be a scene in this play, because it's been trimmed a lot. But I wrote it down and I put it away. And then when I came about 2 years later to start to write this play and start at page one, I got that out, that piece, and I thought, this goes in this play somewhere. This is a piece of this puzzle, but I don't know where. Initially, I thought it was the last scene of the play. It's got to end with that. But ultimately, it wasn't. It was a piece of the puzzle that fit in somewhere else. And in it went, and the play went on and finishes somewhere else.
Well, there's one other element to the play, which is the interaction between younger gay men and the older ones.
Mm-hmm.
Does that reflect on actual conversations you've had?
Yeah, because I was a raging alcoholic, so I went to a 12-step recovery program. Finally, when everybody, stopped speaking to me and said, "We can't have you to our house, you are like a bull in a china closet," either verbally or physically, and you better do something about this. So I did, and I'm 14 years sober, and I listened to share after share after share by people who were young enough to be my sons or daughters or my grandchildren, it seemed like to me. But I heard about their world, and I got seriously involved with some of them. And some of them are still my friends, of course, young and my contemporaries.
That's still a lot to put in a play.
Well, we fudge it here and there.
Well, The Men from the Boys, I saw it on the opening night of previews, and this is kind of a technical question. You were sitting there in the back row, and you spent the entire time, because I would glance back.
Sighing loudly?
Well, no, you were busy taking notes from the beginning to the end. What was on that yellow pad?
Oh, it was probably faster, slower, louder. Deep stuff like that.
There was nothing on the order of, "Oh, damn, this doesn't work, I'm going to cut it," or anything like that?
Yeah, I thought there were lines that didn't work that, just lay there. I thought, get that out of there, for God's sake. I live in Los Angeles, so I've had to come up here every time for important events, like the first, all the casting, first of all. And then once all the guys were cast, the night of the first reading around a table, and we read the play through, and then, of course, they had the opportunity to question, grill me. I was really on the interrogation seat about their character. That's all the actors ever want to talk about. Yeah, I've been part of the process. At the same time, I would learn things. They would pointed out, this couldn't have happened if this happened, and I would see that there were mistakes, chronologically or just technical, and we fixed it that night, some of them. I'd ask them, "Well, what would you do about it?"
When you're sitting there, do you know what the audience is going to be like? Do you get a sense of whether they'll like the play or not?
Oh, yeah, if they're restless and inattentive, or if in fact they leave.
Some reviewer, I forgot what he was writing about the other day, I was reading it. He said, if someone walks out, it sometimes means that you've hit the right nerve.
Well, that's true. I think art ought to inflame and make you think, even if you sit still and keep your seat. Your mental processes may be spinning, But if it doesn't stimulate you in some way, what good is it?
You've been listening to a 2002 interview with Mart Crowley about his play, The Men from the Boys, which is a sequel to the classic The Boys in the Band. Mart Crowley died of a heart attack on March 7th, 2020, at the age of 84. The complete 50-minute interview with Mart Crowley can be found as a Bay Area Theater podcast in the Area 941 section of kpfa.org. I'm Rich Wolinsky on Bookwaves.
Bookwaves is produced by Richard Wolinsky in the studios of KPFA Pacifica Radio in Berkeley, California.
You are listening to KBOO Portland.
Welcome to an encore episode of Words and Pictures, the show about the narrative arts. I'm S.W. Conser. This week, we've set the Wayback Machine to July of 2010, when radical professor, author, and Weather Underground co-founder Bill Ayers came to town. Bill had just published a comics version of his book, To Teach, with the help of illustrator and co-writer Ryan Alexander Tanner. Ryan had been invited to stay at the Chicago home of Bill and his wife Bernadine Dorn during the long writing process. This all took place during the 2008 political campaign of Barack Obama, and there weren't many moments when Bill, Bernadine, or Ryan could step outside the house without being followed around by amateur videographers who were all hoping to record an unguarded moment that might land them on Fox News. While you're enjoying this vintage interview, we'd like to encourage you to take a moment, go online, and support community radio at kboo.fm.